Today is the 25th of the 1st, 2016. I'm interviewing Douglas Twigg, retired farmer of Murakākāhau. I'll ask Douglas now to start off and give us the life and times of his family. Thank you, Douglas.
My great-grandmother, Douglas Mary McCain, immigrated from England with two sons and two daughters to accompany her. She arrived in Wellington 20th of April 1841. She immediately bought a section in Pipitea Street, 28 perches in area. After a while, she bought land, the good acreage in Tiaro, Wellington. The two sons built houses which Mary let to new immigrants. You'll notice from these comments, Douglas Mary was a great entrepreneur, even for those times. Now, Douglas Mary left Wellington in 1860 to live in Pateney, Hawke's Bay, where she lived alternately with her two girls. She died in 1873, aged 84. Now, Julia, her third child, who hadn't immigrated with her mother, she'd stayed in England, and she married Joseph Andrew Torr. They left for New Zealand in 1841, where they set up a store in Lambton Quay. He spent most of his time sawmilling at Kaiwara. This developed into a shipping business of logs, pitsawn timber. He was in partnership with his brother-in-law, William Villiers. Early in 1853, the Torr family, now with eight children, moved to the Esk Valley and bought Pateney Grange. Now, Joseph Torr farmed and shipped 850 bushels of wheat and 10 tons of potatoes in one shipment. This is probably the first recorded sale of European-grown produce from Hawke's Bay. In 1872, he sold the property to Henderson James Twigg, his son-in-law, who had married his daughter Elizabeth Mary Torr, who naturally enough was my grandmother. They had issue Samuel, Francis, Ernest, Desmond, Annie, Violet, Garnet, and two other children as infants. Now Francis, better known as Frank, was the second son of Henderson James Twigg, who was a JP and early settler. He'd immigrated from Ireland and spent his early days in Hawke's Bay on Murakākāhau Station, where he served as accountant, tally clerk, general contact with the staff, with Donald McLean, who was really on Murakākāhau Station. Now, Henderson James farmed Ridgemount with his father, Henderson James, and then Mungaruhi, Wairam, in partnership with his brother Samuel. Later in life, he farmed Riverina, Wairam, Glenbrook, Brooklands, not the subdivided Brooklands, but the huge property that stretched from the bottom of the Apley Road through to encompass Puketap back to where the Brooklands now is farmed. He also farmed, before Brooklands, Tierra Tippi, which he sold to Selby Palmer Sr. And lastly, Hukanui was sold to Thomas Cooper after Francis had farmed there for 43 years. Francis Cassidy Twigg married Olive Edith Russell at the age of 50. They had four children, Russell died as an infant. Douglas of Ngātāroa, Deirdre Atmore of Otaki, and Mary Buxton of Tauranga. Miss Douglas married Kathleen Mary Rawlinson, widow of Donald Rawlinson, a young lawyer. She had two daughters, Karen Ann and Jennifer Mary. Douglas and Kath had one daughter, Fiona Elizabeth, and two sons, Ernest James and Samuel Victor. Kathleen, née Corcoran, had been born in Australia, but emigrated to New Zealand as a child. She was brought up in Oamaru and qualified as a school dental nurse. And later in life, became an elected artist member of the Academy of Fine Arts, Wellington. Douglas, a now retired JP, founded Ngātāroa from the age of 24 until he reached retirement, when he sold most of his lands for vineyards. Karen, senior daughter, married W.W. Williams. Jenny married S.O. Nelson. Fiona married G.M.R. Harris. James is single. And Sam married Bronwyn Catherine Barrett.
Your family must have been amongst the first to come to New Zealand in 1841.
Yeah. And Rabina, her daughter, who was on the boat with her, she was one of the first white women. Te Hariri, she worked for Villiers, looking after his children. His wife was ailing, and she promised on the wife's deathbed to look after the children until they grew up. Well, of course, in time, she married Villiers, who was a lot older than her. But Rabina McCain will go down as one of the first white women at Ahuriri. Of course, some of them smirk and say, well, you know, but that's all in these books where they talk in detail.
Yes. So when you look back and think how traumatic it must have been to come out on a sailing ship, 3 or 4 months, maybe longer, with probably not very good facilities to look after young children. And of course, it's so long ago that we can imagine it must have been very hard.
Yeah, well, even in the Kane family history, she's inclined to skirt through the void, and she'll tell you what produce was worth in New Zealand to
yes.
buy. I don't think it was a hazardous voyage for her, not that by reading the notes. But I didn't mention that Joseph Torr had a sailing boat, or schooner, whatever you had in those days, the Salopian, and that's what he and Villiers was shipping the cargo from. Because
yes.
he was a real trader, and he had a store on the old spit at
yes.
Napier. I think roughly, if you just want to look at my antecedents, I couldn't give you any more detail than
no,
that.
But you said that most of this would be covered in the books, because we can copy those books and attach them to that history
yeah.
you've just given me, and that gives us the full story, doesn't it?
As long as you can guarantee that I get the book back.
Oh yes, we guarantee, we certainly do.
I rang the author of the Torr family history, and she'd been doing audit work, and she said, I'll try and find someone who'll reprint you a copy. So it's only got a spring binder. I don't know where my copy is.
It'll turn up when you're not
yeah,
looking
I know.
For it.
I thought I'd found it the other day.
Just coming back to your family farming, they farmed some pretty big properties
yes,
when
did.
You talk about Brooklands.
And he was single.
Riverina was a big,
yeah.
a tough station. I remember Tony Scotland. It would have been a lot smaller, I would imagine,
when
Tony had it.
Yeah, well, when Dad was at Riverina, Sam owned Mungaroohee, but Sam lived in Napier most of the time, and he popped into, story goes, to Dad at Riverina, and he said, "Look, Frank, I'm off to England on Friday. Just keep an eye on Mungaroohee, will you?"
How big would they have been?
I can't tell you.
Now, the twins of Napier, the solicitors, are they related?
Yeah, we're all Joff. He was the eldest son of the youngest son. And Sam had one boy, Connolly, who was killed in the war. And Francis was the second son. So I being his eldest son, I then became the, what we would have called in old days, the head of the family. But Jock's son was Peter, and in talking with him, he said, "Oh, I thought we were the head of the family." I said, "No." And Des went broke, and Dad was his favourite brother, I think. And Des farmed a block in Kimbolton and Fielding, good stuff, but not a great acreage. And he had all these boys. He thought he'd sell there and bought the Pinnacles at Tauranga. And of course, soon after doing that, he wrote Dad a letter, which I've got, saying wool's worth a penny a pound, and wanted Dad to bail him out. So Dad made the mistake of guaranteeing him, and he put £400 in the Dalgetty's account, I think, in Napier, and they took that and took my uncle's equity, whatever stock,
yes.
Took the lot, and then Des lived in Te Puke all his life. And Dad, who was single, he lived in Roslyn Road in Napier, and his maiden sister lived up Lincoln Road. And the boys boarded with Annie up in Lincoln Road, and Dad paid the piper. He paid for their education.
Yes, yes, yes.
And the only one I ever thought really appreciated it was Frank Junior.
Now, was he the stock agent?
Yeah, your neighbour.
Yes, I knew Frank very well.
And, well, in short, Dad once said to me, "Why don't you dress like Frank? He goes to the sale or goes to buy stock." I'd been to a ram dealer and bought some rams, you see, and I was in my work clothes. And I popped in to see him and have a look. And you knew then that he held Frank.
Yes,
and there is the role model. But those boys, Jock was adjutant to Kippenberger through the big campaigns, and Paddy, he was a hell raiser. He was in a brain gun carrier in the Western Desert with Pat Donnelly. And they got hit with a shell. Paddy lost his leg. He was as big as me. How he got round, I often thought afterwards he might have lost more than the leg, because he didn't have a family. Oh, Pat Donnelly. He got away with it. They were great mates, so you get an idea of Paddy's character and lifestyle.
So yeah. Paddy, where did he live then, after the war?
Paddy joined the loan company as a stock agent, and he was manager, I think, at Tauranga for a long time. He lived at Tauranga, and he married a widow. That's another point. My father didn't marry till he was 50. Jock married someone 20 years younger than him. I married a widow. Frank married a war widow. He was killed at Tarawa. And even that in a close circle, it's quite a thing,
I think, anyway. It is. So coming back to your childhood, where was the family home?
In Havelock, Middle Road, because I subdivided it.
Where was this?
Did you know where Bogle's old two-storied house, old one?
Just past Lucknow Lodge?
Well, then there was Exmoor Street, which was a blind road. That cattle stop down there, I brought it here, and that went over Middle Road, and we had 5 acres there, and it was a long neck. There was about 3 sections of the neck, and then it fanned out, and we had as neighbours Bogle, who was an old Norwegian sea captain. I saw him cutting down pine trees at 92 with a cross-cut saw.
Yes.
He had as a tenant Albie Smith, who came out as a bachelor as a great orchardist later years.
So it does have a name, the property?
Thorndale. We didn't plaster it around, but that's what it was called, Thorndale. And Dad went up to Hukanui on a Monday and came back on a Friday, because Joe Tanner managed Hukanui for 30 years. And when he... Well, he left Hukanui when Sid, his son, was killed in the Air Force in England. And he left, and we couldn't get a really worthwhile manager, because it was tough for a woman, cold as hell, shaded over the house. So Dad went up on a Monday with stores, you know, he'd go to the orchards and get a bit and so on. And we usually were lucky enough to have a married couple, and perhaps what we called a cowboy. So that meant that Mum lived in Havelock with us kids. And we went to St. Luke's Kindergarten. Deirdre was ducks and Mary was ducks. The big room the boys weren't allowed into. So when I turned 5, I had to leave there, and I went up to Mrs. Doyley's, up what they call it now, right? Past Eve's up there. She was on the right.
Was it like a private school?
Yeah, and there was, I think I might have been the only boy. There was Elizabeth Hassel there, and Deirdre went eventually. And then when I outgrew that, probably after a couple of years, I went to Heriworth as a day boy. That was an absolute disaster for me, because remember the eldest brother died as a youngster, and I was the only son left the age of my father then, and I was told not to jump. Don't climb on that chair, you'll fall off. And of course, being thrust into Heriworth with cross country runs and gymnasiums, it was just. And the staff, that chap Buchanan, he picked on a boy called, I'll think about it, but Tony Parker. You know, Tony, he was about 5, and he went there, and his aide parents went off to him and left him there. Well, he couldn't do his boot laces up, you know, he barely went, but he got on all right. So anyway, I could sit there and do an exam with any of them. Eric Glazebrook and I were first equal. Oh, another thing, they were doing the, I think it was the Pirates of Penzance, and John Wendley had the lead, and we all had to be sounded out for the chorus, you see. My name came up, sit over there, you can't sing, you know, and these things sort of stick in your mind. You know, there were some nice teachers, Elder, Norman Elder, and Preston Thomas, who'd come from that Portland Island weather station where he'd been stuck to the wolf. He was excellent. And a chap Dunn wasn't bad. But boy, they were, some of those were sadists. Absolutely. You know, they collected so many detentions. And then on a Monday morning, you had so many, you were caned by Buchanan. And I remember being in the classroom, and this guy started to really cry or scream, and teacher sneered and said, oh, Buck's in good form this morning, isn't he? You know, he was all right to me. I don't think I hold anything against him, but there was one chap, AJ Player, who was another sink child, I think, of aged parents. And every time detention lists were called, AJ Player, 2 detentions. You know, he just shouldn't have been there. And then, of course, it wound up, he was caned. He was a wee bit different, but, you know, I might be the only one who reckons they were sadists, but I'll tell you who was there with me, a good bloke, Mark Brody.
Was he Dick Brody's?
Well, I don't know Dick Brody, but Mark had, his first farm was Ellis Wallace Road.
So if you left Heriworth?
Went to Havelock North Primary School, Standard 3, and clicked straight away. Charlie Pankhurst, did you know? Charlie and I were great mates all through primary. I used to play down the back of the post office, or Charlie was picked up by my mother and driven up to Thorndale and played there. And there was another good guy there, Ken Swanick. By Jove, there was three or four people I wanted to pick to break out of a difficult situation. Yeah. Alec Welsh from Danny Verkai out of Clive. So Havelock North Primary. We used to sing the Marseillaise. Why, I don't know. We ran up the flag, stood to attention, and old Tommy Thompson was headmaster. Well, he had a florid face and a fist that would hit your desk and the inkpot would jump clean out. But he wasn't a sadist, you know what I mean?
Yes,
but
he was
hard and fair, I thought. Well, Tommy Thompson, Gara Nielsen, he used to take those young adventurers like John Phillips and John Niman and Mac Matheson boating in the Tuki-Tuk in the weekend, taught them how to make boats.
Did he become the headmaster later?
Gara Nielsen, no. But the next headmaster was Donald Stuart MacDonald, and he had one kidney. He had one son, Stuart, and he and I were good mates at school. We were good mates when we went to Dannevig. And Mrs. Diana Hoogaboo, did you know her?
Yes, I do.
Used to call her Mad Doris. She was a clever girl, boy.
Yes.
God, she was clever.
Yes.
She wouldn't study. She went to New Plymouth Girls. She was ducks, and should have been a ducks by country mile, but she just sneaked in, and she was ducks, and co-ducks with the headmaster's son, Stuart, who was also pretty brilliant for a primary school kid. And I was tagging along, probably third, and I did a crayon drawing of wartime bombers over Leyte Island, and headmaster said, "It's all out of proportion." I said, "Well, I'm drawing it as if I was in another bomb, I'm looking down on Leyte." "Oh, no, you'll lose marks over this." And that killed my effort. So that really got me through primary school. We had a pretty good team of people there, and I went on to Danny Verkai as a boarder. And so did the Matheson boys, Mousie's deputy head of Hastings boys. So there was Mac, Graham and Noel. We all went there, and even till late in life, Mac and Dorothy always came in here when they're in Hawke's Bay. And he died of cancer. Before he died, he said, "You and Kath are our rocks." Worked for UNESCO and Kabul and all around. So Danny Verkai, I was a boarder, and I won the junior speech competition. Was something. I wasn't much good at sport, but I remember about the fourth form, there was a swimming sport, you see, and I thought, well, it's no good me going in the championship class, so I'll put myself in later in the day in the long distance run. Because I was fresh, and Colin Moore, who was the champion swimmer, they were all getting a bit jaded, and I was fresh, and I couldn't dive, and I wet all the ladies' paperwork as I plunged, and I won by about half the length of the bar. It was nine lengths, I think. Well, straight after that, a housemaster who was damn good to us, Benj, he used to be in Havelock in retirement, Alf Benj, he said, "Oh, after that effort," he said, "I'm going to put you in my fourth 15. He thought I had stickability. Then Gordon Black, he came to high school a bit later, and he and I learned bookkeeping from Hugh Henderson and Alf Reeves, and I was librarian there, and we used to go up and shut ourselves in the library on Sunday afternoon and get the old book one exam papers and sit down and see it, get it out. And Gordon was pretty sharp, you know, he's quick. Now, I remember Don Davidson, who eventually became a partner in Brown Webb, he shoved Gordon's head down the toilet because Gordon said that I should have been a house prefect. Don wasn't. I never really liked him. Brian, his young brother, was better. So anyway, when I left Dannevig, I applied for a job at Brown Webb. And who else should apply was Gordon Black and old Daddy Brown. He chose Gordon, which I would anyway, out of the two, if I was in his place. And I walked down to the Public Trust, and they welcomed me there, and I took over from Jack Begley. I took him to his first game of golf out here in Richmond. Two different types of people, because the juniors and the public trust had to get bookies' doubles charts and fill them in and pass them round on a Friday. And Kevin Percival was there, and that girl who's a great squash player, Devoy's father, Jack, was there. And he was a hell of a nice man. He was cashier. Nothing like her. She appears to be pretty tough. And Bill Shepherd was there. Aidan was his only son. He's done well in life. Oh, and then the staff personnel officer came up from Wellington. He said, "You want to study?" And I said, "Yeah, I wouldn't mind going down." So he said, "Come down to Wellington head office. You can be Will's deposit cadet." So I went down there, and I actually flattered in the public service hostel with Kath's husband. I was godfather to Karen eventually. I didn't mention, but at high school, Gordon and I got certificates of proficiency in Book 1 and Merck Law, I think it was, 1, and they weren't allowed to be counted. You had to sit them again once you'd matriculated. So I was in the public trust there, good year, I suppose. Dad was still trying to farm Hukanui.
Where was Hukanui?
Go straight up, it's right on the skyline. You know the Hutchinson Domain? Straight up, straight up. He went straight on up by horseback to get over the other side to do anything. 3,000 acres up there. And the house was at 2,600 feet. So I went up there to find out the difference between a ewe, a ram and a hoggart.
So that was your first farming opportunity?
Yeah, I just went up on the holidays occasionally. Yes. You had to sit on a quiet hack.
So you were at Wellington still at that stage?
Yeah. So I left them there and they said, "Why are you leaving?" And I explained to them, because I wasn't too impressed on public trust farming properties as trustees, and I thought better, you know, if you don't know much practical farming, but as long as you can watch the LSD. So anyway, I went up there and I was with Dad for about another year and a half, and he was trying to sell it to the government of settlement for £4 an acre, and they wouldn't take it on. They wouldn't look at it. Rabbits were brown on the hill. So Tommy Cooper, who'd been at Heriworth with me, but senior, he had all this property, and he bought it for £5 an acre. His dad said to me, "Will we sell it?" And I said, "Sell it?" For God's sake. You know, you'd put cattle in a paddock, you might lose five because someone put a standard at the top of a hill without footing it, and the weight of the wires
pull it down
and walk over into no man's land. That's where Dunedin is now. So anyway, then I rode my hack from Hukanui to the swamp road and I went shepherding. Where would I go first? I think I went to Tunanui, and Alex Sinclair and I got on spot on.
He used to manage it for the Russell City.
Yeah, and yes. Alan Joel was married shepherd, and he, as long as I talked racing, he'd dig the post hole. We got on damn well, Alan, and he had a very nice wife. She was the war widow from Tarawa, like Frank's wife. Yeah. And anyway, the general, I lived in a sort of a chauffeur's loft. Have you been into Tunanui? Yeah. Well, it was handy for the garden, you know, single boys, right? And he used to let me borrow books from his library, one at a time, or two at a time, like the battle plans of Genghis Khan. If you took that, you're allowed a lighter one as well. But you had to have one. There was military history. Then I left there, and Alex Sinclair said, "You go up the road and live in that little worry of mine and look after my block further up the road." Right next door was Tommy Dicer, who'd married D.S. McDonald's widow.
Is that Tosh's father?
No, Tosh's uncle. Bill was Tosh's.
That's right.
And she used to have me in the morning tea, cream cakes. It was just that bad halfway around my beat. And no, that was good times up there.
Was Peggy
Peggy, well, she's older than me. She was Bill's daughter.
She's at Ilsthorpe, anyway.
Yeah, one of the big families out there, married one. And Sheila was my vintage. And I was at a dance there where Sheila first met Rob Comrie. And that was easy to see. It was love at first sight of it. Ever there was love at first sight. Because Rob had been down the varsity with us in Wellington. And when he bought that bit of land right up the top, Sheridan, no man's land, his father, the lawyer, put an ad in the public notices, "I will not be responsible for any debts incurred by my son." That sticks in my mind, because Rob wasn't a bad guy. Anyway, he married Sheila, and I was up there probably for 2 years. I had to cross the road to go to the toilet. There used to be a dog's leg thing there, and he owned the bit of land on the other side of the road, and that's where the long drop went. And of course, David Hildreth was wafting round the district then, and the property he eventually bought was property of a mental patient, and the Tunanui Shepherd sort of did the stock work. And anyway, it was put up for sale. And the general decreed that Stan McCauley would get it. It was a leasehold block. And that's for Stan. Anyway, Stan never got a bid. It was David Hildreth and me. And Dad went to 10 guineas for the leasehold. It was going to cost £40 to freehold it. And David got it on 11, the leasehold. So Glen Elmer stud, where he stood. Yes. And then Tookie Hindmarsh was up the road. Incidentally, his father was my first bookie. My mother bet with him, and when we were 15 or so, she let me have 5 shilling bets.
So you were corrupted from a young age?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, Irish from my mother's side. Newark was there because his son, Des, was friendly with Charlie and me. So after Sherrandon, I came down here and I worked at Glen Eyres for a lambing beat. That was so-so. The manager was a stud Angus man, and unless the paddocks were like that. And then he'd put in lamb two-tooth ewes in them, and they popped bearings. Anyway, he was a good stock manager, but his head shepherd was Merv McLaren. And when he retired, he ran the Storford Lodge office. And his son's done very well in the South Island on stud stock. And I did a stint ocean bench, which was beyond me. You know, dogs had been doing 500 acres. An Ocean Beach Howpry station was 7 miles along the beach.
Well, who owned it at that stage?
Ian Gordon, and his wife was of Brocklehurst, and her father was Dean of St. John's, and her mother was killed in the earthquake. A beam or something fell on her.
So your dogs found it a bit tough, 7 miles
down the beach, and no water. And the manager had so many dogs behind him, just a pack of barkers and pushers. He coped all right with them. He's dead now. So virtually from there I came here. And
so Michael Gordon would be Ian Gordon's son?
No, Michael's son. Yeah, and Jean was his eldest sister who married John Slavelle. And then he had another sister who married an accountant in England. And then there was Michael. And Graham Thelwell was manager. He'd just married. His wife was a champion swimmer, I remember. And what they did, they must have given a paddock or two right in the centre of Tauranga. And you confirmed that, Michael. Of course, it wasn't a unit, and it lasted so long and no more. And then he went out and bought in the Swamp Road. And he's quite a bit younger than me. His father used to wander around in Scottish plaids and hammer shanters.
I've known Michael since when they were first married and went out to the farm. He's not a fool. So over the years, I always remember going out to Swamp Road. He had all his father's trophies in the wool shed, all the tiger's heads and lion's heads. I don't know what's happened to them now. Yeah, he married
Robin. She was the only child. Kath knows her quite well.
Yes. So you came back to here, into this area.
I came from Alex Sinclair's to here, because it was just about the start of lambing. And Alec wasn't too pleased that I got the opportunity. I came down here on a Sunday. Jim Scott drove us round. And he said, well, you'll have to make up your mind. He wants £100 an acre for it. It won't last long on the market, you know, and pressurised Dad. I didn't have anything to put in. Anyway, we signed up that Sunday afternoon.
So how many acres?
I think there is 156 in the original corner. That was called the windmill paddock. And then shortly after that, his brother Harry, I got this block and I got 40 acres down the other side of Weds, which is the deal. And then his brother had 30 acres on the other side against Matt Gray. And he said, oh, if you want to buy it, you can buy it. And I said, well, give me first refusal. I just don't want to at the moment. So over the fence, old Derek made the blue. He said, oh, he said, I've been looking at a block of land down there and he wants too much for it, of course. He said, I've got first refusal on that block. And if he hadn't have said it, he'd have got it, and I paid the same money. But it was a lighter paddock than the one next door, and Mason Water worth at least the two. Mason was my father's sort of advisor.
Well, he used to come to Napier Boys High and instruct us in sheep husbandry.
I've got three grandsons there now. The triplets are there, Sam's triplets. Just shows you've got to watch when you're talking about land locally, you know. He didn't like it either. And then when Gary and I were negotiating with Rouse for the Paratu, because Rouse had about 80 acres of, well, he had some land, no, all on his side of the road was Rouse land. Well, Derek, when he heard that Gary and I were negotiating sort of as a partnership, he hopped in, got into Bill's pocket and got 90 acres. It must have been Rouse land. Anyway, he got a paddock over here somewhere. And Gary wouldn't have anything to do with him because of something. So when the auction came up, I've still got Gary's papers that he drew up that I signed. And no matter what I bought at auction, he knew, told me or showed on the paper what I'd pay for 110 acres, which had the stream in it up there. And all they wanted was the graveyard paddock by the washpool entrance for their trust. So we got Jim Scott to bid for us, and Clinginger was, he was the auctioneer, Dick Clinginger. Yeah. And for ages it went pound for pound for pound, and the underbidder was Jeff Russell, whose wife had just sold Elephant Hill. If she hadn't put that deal through, we'd have picked it up for nice money. Anyway, that's how I got that. But Gary was damn good. When Wellwood's for sale, he took me round it. He said, you should buy this stake. And I said, I'm not going to buy it because of the leasehold of the riverbed. It made the farm. Gordon Kelch got a leasehold upstream. And I said, as soon as I get it and the lease expires, Gordon will get my piece. And I said, no, forget about it. Well, Gary got it because I only made about £33 an acre or something, you know. I think they were the only bidders, but I didn't go to that auction. But I'm quite glad I didn't buy it, because you've only got so much equity. You know what it is? I'd rather, I always wanted what was known as Jollies. That's where Rouse, I always wanted that, and I thought I've got to play my cards. So of course, when it came to buying that, I just had to go to my financiers and say, well, first mortgage on that, first mortgage on this, should only owe family money. And there was hardly any more borrowing involved. Yeah. Cause they couldn't dispute that this collateral wasn't worth per acre what that was. So that's roughly how I got here.
Now, Tarra was a special area to farm. If you didn't farm it early, there was nothing to farm, was
there? No, it was just like this. And you had to have hay or something. Because I always had the sheep on at about 5 or 6 or 7 per acre in every paddock. Yes. But I had hay or used to buy chickpeas that they used to feed ducks, and maize, barley. I've worked out that you fed barley when it was as hard as this, so they picked up every grain. Once it rained, you switched to maize. There wasn't the wastage. Yes.
So that means you've been farming this farm for how long?
I asked Kath, when did we get married? She couldn't remember. I know I bought the farm the year Bosol won the last race at Hastings. Paid £70. Led all the way. But somewhere I'll find. Actually, I'd say 60-odd years. Yeah. Or thereabouts.
And it's an interesting area, because who would have thought 60 years ago that this would be a prime vineyard area? Yes, it's amazing the transformation. You're living in the middle of a green belt now, yeah, aren't you?
Well, Gary, he said that once all these vineyards come on, we'll get a lot of passing showers. There will be no more thermals, and we do. We get showers we never have got.
So mainly it's been a fat lamb farm, hasn't it?
Yeah, fat lamb. But I couldn't pass a beginner's test in farm theory. I wouldn't, honestly. I've never learned to shear with a handpiece. My father taught me to shear with the blades. And
but that hasn't held you back, has
no,
it?
No, it hasn't, because this was going to be an irrigation scheme on its own, water dike from the river. Ministry Works surveyed every acre. And then, when it was all there and we're sort of ready to find out what it would cost us to buy the water, I said, oh, there won't be enough water in the Narrow River when you want it. God, I was chairman of that. The economist from the Ag Department said to me, before it was wiped, he said, you know, you won't net anything more off an irrigated block than you do as you're doing it. They had all the figures.
It's about timing, isn't it? When the grass is growing, when you've got the sheep.
I've still got the bit on the swamp road. You know that paddock? It's probably the longest. It was my father's bullock paddock for Hukanui.
So whereabouts on Swamp Road is it?
Coming from Fern Hill, you know where the big pine plantation was on the hill, Tim's?
Yes.
In front of there, it goes right back under the hill, all flat, to the stream. The stream's two sides. And I lease it to Peter Clayton. He bought Henner's house, and he's had it probably for 6 or 7 years.
The Henner block, Ethel Curtis, McCutcheons, Trevor Taff, and of course Michael Gordon bought Trevor Taff's block.
Yeah.
Where are you in relation to those?
Well, I'm right below Peter Clayton. You know where Ann Barrison used to be? Straight below there.
Right.
You've got a bridge across the drain. There's no number on the gate because we haven't got a residency.
So you've got some heavier country.
Yes, it was due to flood, and I grew 13 crops of maize in a row. It's a guy, Maranui Road, who sort of looked after the workings of it and planting.
Danny Beasley?
Danny. He was my father confessor.
Yes, sir. You or someone behind you there.
I stayed here. I said, I'll write out the checks, Danny. Yes. And so he did it for years. And I leased it to Johnny Bostock, and he took summer crops all and didn't do much in the winter with it. But I leased it to him for the year, and then he got caught with a crop. It rained at New Year or something. And if I'd been here, I was a techie on holiday. I used to go out with a wide mouth shovel, spend the morning just breaking the furrow lines.
Yep, letting the water away.
I'd have lost some crops of. I lost one crop of peas when I was away too, but he lost one. And he said, oh, I'm not going to lease it again unless you drain it properly. So I leased it then to Johnny Moffat, and Johnny was his father. And he had it probably 5 or 6 years. He was making noises if it was too wet. So Johnny's father said to me, look, the boys and I will organise a proper drainage scheme with two pumps. So I said, well, you do that. You just tell me what it's you reckon it's going to cost? And he said, oh, about $50,000, you see. And I said, well, do it, but I don't want to be involved at all. I'll write out a cheque at the end. And his son is a qualified engineer, and he looked after the pump and our Kerry drainage. Yes. They did the
drainage
and put a great centre pipe in, and like a herringbone with feeler pipes out. It's gone from there. It's 10 miles from here. Years ago, Don Struthers used to drive a few cattle back and forward, you know, for me.
But, you know, I suppose that's drained. There's no problem with wetness. So it's beautiful land when it's drained.
So Clayton, what he does, he leases back to Bostock for a summer crop, and then he puts it to a winter crop, fattening, and he's made a hole or a gate in the fence where he can have cattle going up on the hill to camp, and they come down grazing. So he farms it damn well. I'm always happy with him. His mother was a Dearden from Waipak. Well, these Deardens up here are his cousins.
So that's your farming, and over the period of the last 20 years, your farm has diminished in size because you've sold to some of the local...
Well, you know who, the vineyard. I've only got 50 acres left. Yes. The damn council, they say 50 acres is minimum. I think you can get round it if you sell to a neighbour. You just have a boundary.
There's ways of doing it. I've seen that. So you have had some other interests as well as being a farmer. Were you ever follow the dog trials? Or?
No. I've had my own dog trials here. Never any good with the dog. No, I
so the dogs were really trials.
Racing. Racing morning and night.
Did you ever own a horse?
No.
So you totally were an investor?
I didn't do much of that. Yes. I used to go to Trentham. We'd get a taxi at 4 o'clock in the morning at the clock tower. Go to Trentham with £4 in the pocket. There were 8 races, and that was 10 shillings to win. One horse in each race. And I'd never spend any more. I might have a pie at lunch, but racing was only on a Saturday. Spent all week studying.
Well, I always remember going to Wellington, to the Wellington Steeplechase.
And you'd miss a race.
This was in 1959.
Yeah. Now, Meikle had a huge number. I saw a green light race down there with Paramore and Kentucky Flight fell at the last fence, and Greenlight didn't know how to fall, but he didn't know how to race much either. And he plodded through the mud, and he won it. Waddle jumped on Kentucky Flight as if to, he was so far in front of Greenlight, and Greenlight actually beat him in the slog in the mud. Meikle's date and Howard Glazebrook shared in some horse. Peas Blossom was one. And Nolan, I remember Nolan, he worked for the church.
The monastery down in Kotokoa. He went down there as a silent monk, but Nolan had too much talk in him to be a silent monk.
And David was his brother.
Yes. Well, David's dead now. Nolan's dead.
Ploughman was their manager.
That's right. So then you certainly had some interest in politics over the period.
I've been a National Party supporter since my first vote, and I've never wavered. I pay my sub every year, but I don't like this chap out of Waimarama. Well, he came here, and we had all the organisation, you know, how good it was. And I rang him, I said, look, if you want to know anything about the election, give me a ring, and if I don't know it, I'll find out. He never ever rang me.
No, it's a funny thing, Douglas. I always remember the day that Tim Symes, he formed a deputation with himself, and he came to see me when we were living in Thompson Road and said, would I like to form a branch at Brookvale? And I said, oh, yes.
I think I was with Tim that day.
Well, you may have been.
Because we had two branches to form, that one and cutting something half. Anyway, that's a
but it's a long time ago.
My job was to make sure there's enough money to keep the dues paid to Wellington. That was my...
There are no books anywhere for Hawke's Valley. No one knows where the minute books are. All the records.
A lot of them were here. given them in to his office.
Craig Foss's office?
Into Foss.
Have you? Were they Hawksbay Electric records?
Yes, and right back, they should have known I had
But
them.
How long ago was that?
Well, it went back, it was just a small bound book, and I think National Party was formed about 1930 from then.
I rang Wellington the other day, and I got hold of James Austin, and he said he'll have a look, see where they're in some of the archives. Nobody knows.
What a fool they were. I had sitting at my desk, Kath or someone dropped it in, just over the counter. And I rang them back about a month later. Did you ever receive those records of mine? Oh, yes, we gave them to the Hastings branch. She said, I'll get them back. Or, you know.
Was this in the last 12 months earlier?
24 months, probably.
I've been talking to them over the last 18 months about any records. I've spoken to Foss, I've spoken to his secretary.
Yeah. Well, we left them into that office on the court. I couldn't leave them in, so I must have been getting to this stage. You know, I've been like this in various degrees for quite some years. And I thought, well, I'll follow it up and see if you've given them to Foss. Mac Menzies proposed me off the floor for chairman when I was new to the district. And it goes back, some of the old chaps like Sally Bogart's father, those sort of people, they were all, you know, there was a page probably for each year. It wasn't sort of full of ideas. And
it's just the history. We've got no idea who the people were. Somewhere, someone will, they will be somewhere.
It's a black bound book. It'll be about as big as that. Probably foreshortened a wee bit. And it's got ruled paper. I bet that I'm mentioned in more than half the page. It's at least in their office.
Now, coming back to Kath, you made mention that you used a flat with Don, her husband.
Well, her boyfriend then.
And you became
godfather
to her
first daughter.
And then you became
their father. And it's the godchild's on the same birthday as mine.
Isn't that wonderful? So where did you meet? Was Kath a local person?
She came from Oamaru. And she was a dental nurse, Geraldine. Don was in the government law office in Wellington. He was brilliant, but he had rheumatic fever, and they married and lived in the street behind the Havelock Primary School, Campbell Street. And old Reeves, I think he helped her out a bit, you know, in Dan Hurst House. And I was living in Havelock. When Don died, my mother, she was very good to Kath, and her mother was in Christchurch. Kath's mother. So we got engaged. We've been married a long time. We're both pretty strong.
And she plays with paints. She's an artist.
Yeah, of some renown.
Yes,
she
yes.
hides her light under a bushel.
Yes,
know.
Yes. So she had
two little girls.
And then you've had
Fiona, James, and Sam. Karen's got Bialoba. She's in Waipu, the eldest.
Oh, what's Bialoba?
She's perfectly healthy, keeps herself pretty spick and span, but has to be drugged up for head and hereditary. And she's very hard on Kath. You know, if Kath brings a present, she's, oh no, I'm not having that, it's poison. I wouldn't let Kath go and see her on Christmas Day if we were going to Jen and Sam's. Kath's pretty sensitive. I knew if she'd had a tear bashing. Spoil her whole life. So I said, no, we're not going. And she, Kath didn't really object. We went between Christmas and New Year. And that wasn't too successful. Best thing that happened, we were coming out of there, and who should be going in but Ted and Shirley. So we had a good chat, and Ted livened the situation. He doesn't look any different. He and Robin Bell were good mates. They owed together. Well, Robin Bell, Elizabeth would have been a year older than me. If Robin had been alive, I think if he's Ted and Robin were of an age, he'd be 83, 84.
Yeah.
He still writes a sharp letter.
He does.
Talking about interests, well, really racing's first, then the National Party. I'm not participating at the moment, but boating, and farming would be last, bookkeeping, accounts, doing accounts. Love it.
Yeah. See, that's a side of you I never knew, that you'd done all your training. Your mind was focused on accounting.
Yeah, I wasn't too bad.
But the old story, Douglas, you don't have to be a precise farmer to be a successful farmer. A lot of good farmers fail because they weren't good bookkeepers.
No, that's right. I'd say to a young bloke, you must have a bit of capital or equity. Mm. And then as long as you're good with your books, and account for everything. I taught Sam a fair bit, and he's pretty good. The girls are pretty good, but I taught them sort of, like Sam had looked in the paper, and if there was two cattle beasts for sale, Jersey Cross down at Puckypuck, we'd go down and buy them for cash and truck them home, and he got the proceeds less the cost of carting. That sort of thing when he was 5 or 6. Otherwise, I didn't like dancing. I wasn't really a social butterfly. I admired Kay when she was young, one of the best looking girls. Mm. She was, wasn't she?
Yes. Well, I suppose, you know, here we are sitting in this lovely oasis in the middle of Ngātāraua summer. Well, it's really just another summer, isn't it? So I think that probably gives us a fairly good idea who you are, where you came from and what you did. Today is the 10th of the 3rd, 2016. This is an addendum to the other side of their family. Douglas, would you like to now tell me something about that?
Yes. Now, Henderson James Twigg, grandfather of Douglas Russell Twigg, was born in Thorndale, Ireland. He immigrated to New Zealand, where in 1862 he applied for a position on Maria Kakaho Station. Donald MacLean engaged him as secretary bookkeeper in 1864. For 6 years he helped administer the station before leaving in 1870 for Pateney, north of Napier. The following year Henderson married Elizabeth Torr, daughter of James and Julia Torr. Taking up residence in Pateney, he farmed the Pateney Grange with his father-in-law. Later in life, he bought the Grange, where he and Elizabeth raised Samuel, Francis, Ernest, Garnet, Desmond, Annie, and Violet.
Right, now, Kath will tell us something of her family's line. Thank you, Kath.
Kathleen's family originated from Wicklow in Ireland. Her grandmother, Alice Manley, née O'Collar, from Omeru, was a highly respected resident and early pioneer of North Otago. Alice's father was an imperial officer in the British Army for 23 years. He served in the Crimean War and Indian Mutiny, and at Queen Victoria's command, he returned to England, where at Buckingham Palace, Her Majesty Queen Victoria decorated him for bravery and distinguished service. Kathleen Mary Corcoran lived in Omeru and spent much of her younger life at her family's farm at Duntroon, Otago. Later, she went to Wellington to train to be a school dental nurse. Kathleen eventually moved to Hawke's Bay, where for many years she has been a well-known exhibiting artist in Hawke's Bay and is also an elected artist member of the Academy of New Zealand Fine Arts, Wellington. Kathleen and Douglas have lived at Ngātāraua for many years and have 3 daughters and 2 sons.
Where did you go to school then, Kath?
I went to the Omeru South School. I remember going up, going up the hill, and I knew when I was coming down there'd be this horrible little dog. And I used to run down the hill to try and avoid him. But very often I fell and skinned my knees.
So what was Omaru like those days?
Oh, boring.
Because it was a bustling port once, wasn't it? With lots of grain stores down by the wharf. I stopped off to have a look at Omaru a couple of years ago. Some beautiful old buildings there.
Oh, there are. They've refurbished them. They're all made from Omaru stone.
And so that was your primary schooling at Omaru.
Yes.
Did you go to a high school?
I went to the high school. Yes. I had a bicycle. Mother bought me a bicycle, which I used to clean every weekend because it was shining and beautiful and like new.
And so then you went to dental school.
Oh, well, they called me up in September, unfortunately, because I was going to be in the Gondoliers play. So I was torn between two. But I thought the better of it, and because my mother was a widow, I thought, well, I would be quite independent because we were paid while we trained. And I enjoyed it. But when I'd finished my training, I wanted to go on and learn more and be a dentist. But somehow, it didn't happen.
And your interest in art, has that always been with you, or
yes,
did you develop that?
It was something I had to do, like going to the bathroom and cleaning your teeth. It was something in me that drove me to keep up with it. But of course, during the years when the children were little, and being father decided that I was in charge of the children and he was in charge of the farm, I was either in the kitchen or looking after my children. So I didn't have too much time to draw.
No. It's interesting, there was an article in this morning's paper about W.J. Rush, and it was saying about he was an architect, very busy, but they said there was hardly a day that he didn't paint something. And some of his paintings do look like that.
Yes, I've actually got one.
I've got two or three. But there's going to be a big sale of them soon in Hawke's Bay. Someone has had a big collection and they're all going to be released and sold. And that art has carried on right through your life and you're still doing it now.
Yes, I've and got one still down at the New Zealand Academy at the moment. Mind you, part of that painting, I had done some time ago. And I just, like a lot of artists do, you don't know what to do next. So I gave it a rest. I put it against the wall, so to speak. And then when this request from the Academy came up to do art from the heart, I thought, by Jove, I'll get that painting out. And, you know, it just seemed to all fall into place.
It's about mood, isn't it?
Timing, more than mood. Yes. Timing.
So you became a North Islander eventually?
Yes, well actually I married before and Don was a barrister and solicitor and
where
he
was this?
Unfortunately died.
This was in Wellington, was it?
No, we came up to Hawke's Bay and we lived in one of those cottages in Campbell Street. You know, a certain person used to build those buildings.
Chapman.
And for a thatched roof.
Yes, I know.
What was his name?
Chapman Taylor.
And we bought a section over the road where we planned to, Don planned out the house that we were going to live in. But it didn't happen. Died. I had a baby of 13 months and one of 2 years.
Yes, those Chapman Taylor houses are both still there. There's the one on the corner and then there's a small one just down from the corner.
We lived in that little one to begin with.
And so then we were left with two little babies and...
Yes, I must remind you of an incident where I used to put the pram. It's when Karen, my first child, I used to put her out in this pram under this tree. And one morning, I must have been a bit late doing it because there'd been a storm and it... That huge bough came right down where I used to put the pram.
Was this off the gum tree?
So, I was absolutely horrified. Yeah. I thought how fortunate I was that I hadn't been early.
And so then you married Douglas?
Yes, he was the godfather of my eldest child. And we had difficult years, but it was because I think Douglas became sort of the cry of the children, or, you know, what's the baby crying for, and all this sort of thing. Rattled him somehow.
We didn't hear those sounds out on the farm, did we, Douglas?
No.
The wives heard them only because we were never home.
And it certainly was difficult.
Oh, well, dear, it's a two-edged sword, I suppose. It takes two to tango.
I was the mother of those children. Yeah. That made the difference.
Okay, well, is there anything else that you can think of? And then I'll switch back over to Douglas.
Well, you didn't mention Geraldine, Kath.
Well, I saved his life just recently. Did you know about that?
No.
One day...
Oh, does Geraldine come first?
I used to be a dental nurse there.
Would you like to just tell us about your time in Geraldine?
Oh, it was a very happy time. I was friends with a lady who lived across the creek, as we called it. And I flatted with a girl who was a, I can't quite remember what it was now, but she did a two-year course in teaching. And we got on fine. Mm. You know, we worked out without any upsets or quarrels or arguments. But she's not alive now. She died. Nolene Lindsay's sister. And apparently Nolene Lindsay was the spoilt one in the family. There were two girls. And the father and she used to go for trips over to Europe and round about. And Beverly would look after her mother, who, strangely enough, had a health problem where when she had a baby, she became quite paralysed. Yeah, but she was all right during the pregnancy. And what caused it, goodness knows.
Yeah, so that would have been a pretty little place to be in, Geraldine, wouldn't it?
Yes, it's a lovely little place.
It still
place.
Is a nice town.
I was sole charge of the clinic there. And some mornings, it was in the winter, it was so cold, my hands were absolutely numb, and my feet, and I had to, you know, clap my hands right under the tap.
And you would have had one of those drills that you pump your leg up and down on?
No, they didn't have those then, but they've got them now. I don't really approve of those. But anyway, no, it was a good time. Very good time. And what was the next question?
You said you saved Douglas.
Oh, yes. Well, he'd been saying for a few days, oh, how did that feel? Don't feel all that good. Oh, and I said, so I'll stop you moaning. I'm sure a lot of women have to say that too. Anyway, this particular day, he suddenly went as white as a sheet. And I said, Douglas, keep breathing. And I started pushing his diaphragm, made him breathe. And then the next thing, it came into a flush and sweat all over his head. And he told me later his shirt was soaking. And I called the ambulance, and they eventually came. And you know what the driver said to me? Not the driver, but the man who was with a driver. He said, oh, fancy calling us out all this way just because your husband doesn't feel well. Anyway, they took him in, and I went in with him. And I'd rung Fiona, and she rang Jen up the road outside. By the daughter, and we went in, and no sooner had he got to the hospital than they decided he had to be flown to Wellington to have a pacemaker. They don't do it at the Hastings Hospital. And so I went down on the bus to see the exhibition opening, and my son James in Auckland shouted me a night at Ridges Hotel. And I loved that. It was great. And then the next morning, I got a taxi up to the hospital, and I saw Douglas. And he had to be there for, 5 days? And then they flew him back on a hospital plane again when they had enough passengers. Two were coming down from Wairoa. And Then he came back and he went to the Hastings Hospital.
Oh, to be monitored. I must say, Douglas looks better. The last time I was here, he's quite different, actually.
It's taken a long time to...
But he's really back to normal. Grumpy.
but some of us were born that way. I'd better make it the plural rather than point it at you, Douglas.
I've got to get the whip out now and again. Because
yes.
He really should exercise.
Which I can.
But he also should have his legs up now and be right back. You know, but he does what he wants to do.
But isn't it wonderful how quickly they can do things? You know, you're here and you're down there and next thing, there's a whole lot of these young suited men come and have a look at you and you think, God, these boys are not old enough to be out of high school yet.
But no more than most of the older blokes.
If there's anything else you can think of?
It takes me back to time when my sister and I were children and we decided we'd go for a swim. And so we took a picnic lunch and we swam over to the other side. And then my sister, who's deaf, suddenly, as we were swimming back, she grabbed me around the neck. And I thought, oh, I can't talk to her. She can't hear me. I'll just keep going. And I noticed that the river was quite swift on the other side. And there was a big log there that seemed to be stationed there. It was probably a tree. And I kept swimming and swimming in the water. I don't know how I did it. It was just determination, power and focus. And we got there. And I don't think anybody else in the family knew about it.
Was she just frightened?
Yes, she got tired.
So she was holding on to you for support but choking you.
Just about, we could have been both drowned.
Yes, we can all look back and think of little things like that. Some things we never tell anyone about. Kath has got just a few more details.
Yes, well, my three lovely daughters, Karen, Jenny and Fiona, and James and Sam.
And they're all local?
Well, James lives in Auckland. Sam lives down off the Porongahau Road in Ormond country. And, yes, Karen's in Havelock, Fiona's in Havelock, and Jenny's farming with Sam. She married again, and she's with Sam Nelson. His first wife died in a terrible riding accident.
And grandchildren?
Yes. Fiona and Mark have two sons. One's engaged over in Canada, and Andrew, or Andy as we call him, is in Wellington, and he also is engaged to be married, and he works in the ANZ Bank. I think he's in charge of 34 people. So we see them from time to time. And Toby, Ron and Sam's eldest boy, is down in Canterbury now at Elam.
At Lincoln. Toby's at Lincoln College.
Oh, well. I thought he was at university.
But you said Elam, that's an art school.
No, it's a university.
Anyway.
And Ireland's in Auckland, isn't that right?
Ireland's in Canterbury. That's the boarding area for Canterbury University, Ireland House. My son was there.
Well, that's Elam. Elam's in Canterbury, and that'll be a boarding where he lives. Oh, I'm not sure. No. Anyway, confused me now, Douglas.
He's down in Canterbury.
Lincoln College.
And three other boys who are, yes, I'm not allowed to call them triplets anymore. That's Joseph, Louis and Isaac.
Triplet boys.
At Napier Boys High School. And strangely enough, Douglas's father went there.
Before 1900.
I went there before 1950. 50 years later.
Were you a good pupil?
Absolutely. Perfect pupil. And I must tell you this, of all the strange things, I wanted to be an accountant. And for the life of me, when I think of all the accountants I've dealt with over my life, they are the last people I'd want to be.
I reckon it's a very stressful life to be an accountant.
And do you see them regularly?
Oh, yes, we do.
You can always send them back, though, can't you, the grandchildren?
Oh, now we've got great-grandchildren too.
Oh, have you? Oh,
yes.
How many of
yes,
those?
We've got four. Two in Hastings and yes. two over in Perth. Sarah, my daughter, Jenny's eldest daughter, she has Madeline and Oliver. We were all delighted that she had a boy. He's
yes.
a Bonnie, and he's just a spitting image of his father. And Maddie is just like her mum. There's a photo of them up there. And the two at the bottom there, those are Rachel and Henry's two little girls, Ruby and Poppy. And just the one above is Maddie and Oliver. Yes, but he's walking now.
Well, the two little girls' mother is head about it. Lindisfarne, Rachel, and her husband is sports teacher and he's a housemaster. So they've been granted the use of a Lindisfarne house.
It's a two-story house, and they've got a little garden, and they've even got a little coop with chooks. And they've got this wicker basket, which is about that tall, a long handle, and a narrow. And imagine the two little girls going to the little coop picking up
So, any of the children arty?
Rachel isn't. It's not the art that I do. It's computer art, and I don't call that art.
Sure.
I think hands-on art is art. But she was at 4 years at college in Palmerston, so she learned everything there was to learn. And her mother used to say she was institutionalised. But anyway, she met this chap. He actually came out of Henry as an exchange student. And they just clicked, these two. We've met his mother and father. They both married different people again. Quite involved, really. He has an aunt who lives further up the island here. Or a half-sister, I think. Yeah, half-sister. He's a very good cook. He's amazingly good at cooking. And very quick. You know, and gets the cushions puffed up and the curtains tidy and it's all done. And, and Rachel's the opposite.
All right. Is there anything else that you can think of, Douglas?
Not really, but I think Kath would like to know where all this is channeled. But wouldn't you, Kath? In the hall, Kath, didn't you?
Yes, it all happened in the hall.
This is the Maraikākahu.
Yes, the Maraikākahu Hall. And I considered, because I had extended myself, I thought, well, what about all the other farmers' wives up here? They're just sort of stuck at home and having cups of coffee and cooking and baking and all that sort of thing and sending children to school. And they haven't got anything to extend themselves, so I decided, as I've told you, I would get someone to come and show them how to do knitting, patchwork, quilt making, all different kinds of sewing, and also to make bread. I got someone else to come out and show us how to make bread and buns, and we did all that. And then another thought was, but it did start up people going to the hall more and playing badminton. And, you know, then Kereru started doing things.
Yes.
So it sort of planted a seed. And it made people happier and they got to know each other.
The butcher, you said you had a butcher to come and teach you how to cut meat up as well.
Yes, we did.
That's a good idea because most wives or husbands, unless you're a farmer, had to find that out for themselves.
Well, Kath got the butcher. He was quite an identity in Hastings.
I can't remember his name.
He had something to do with Richmond's. Do you know him? No, he used to conduct cookery classes, butchery classes in Hastings.
Yes, I know who you're talking about.
He's probably the best commercial butcher we had at the time.
I know when we go down to see Sam and Bron, we haven't been for ages because they're really busy with their horses and Sam's busy with his real estate. And we used to buy meat at the Waipawa butchery, a very good butcher there, a really nice man.
Makes great sausages and saveloys.
Yes.
I've got friends in Havelock that go down there to buy their salves and sausages.
I used to go in and behind the counter, you've got a freezer. And I said, what have you got hanging up? I'd say, well, I'll take the hindquarters of that one. I didn't want the forequarters. But I bought a lot of meat at that time, you know, $40 worth or something. And he never jibbed. I'd buy just the loin chops, not shoulder chops and rubbish that they have now. But he was quite happy with it. We bought meat here for years, you know. I used to get reject lambs from Wakker. That was good stuff, and the low-weighted ones.
They might have had a bruised leg or something.
Three-legged ones. We used to buy our meat there too.
And then when I sort of eased up on farming, I just home killed. I never killed cattle, but I sometimes went to the chain at Wakker too when I was killing cattle off the swamp road. Said, keep me a hindquarter off that one. And they present it to me as a hindquarter. And I'd bring it back, and it wasn't that kitchen table. It was a bit of an ordeal, you know, breaking it down. But it was nice meat.
He'd hung it down at the tree down there, the guillotine thing. We used to have a safe where he used to make butter too.
What do they call those things that you hang the meat on?
The little hook and spreads behind the gamble.
Gamble, that's right. All right. Well, I think that was just a nice, quiet little chat.
I think
chat.
You can have a chuckle when you're reading something.
Today is the 22nd of April, 2016. This is just a small add-on about Douglas's family.
My father, Francis Cassidy Twigg, was born at Pateney in 1874. The second son of Henderson James Twigg and Elizabeth Nitor Twigg, early settler from Ulster, Scotland, who farmed the Pateney Grange in the Esk Valley. Here Francis spent his boyhood. He was educated at the Pateney School, Napier Boys High School, Lincoln Agricultural College. He farmed Ridgemount Station with his father before joining his brother Samuel as partners in Mungaruhi Station, Wairoa. In later life, he farmed the Hawke's Bay properties of Riverina, Glenbrook, Brooklands, Tiratipi, and lastly Hukanui. He married Olive Edith Russell from Gisborne. Together, they had two sons and two daughters. Russell, his eldest son, died in infancy. His surviving son, Douglas Russell Twigg, farms at Ngātārawa, while his daughter, Florence Deirdre Atmore, lives in Otaki. His youngest daughter, Mary Olive Buxton, has retired to Tauranga. There are nine grandchildren: Ernest James Twigg, Samuel Victor Twigg, Karen Ann Williams, Jenny Mary Gilbertson, Fiona Elizabeth Harris, Paul Atmore, Graham Atmore, David Atmore, Susan Wilson. The great-grandchildren are Tobias Twigg, Joseph Twigg, Louis Twigg and Isaac Twigg, Benjamin Harris and Andrew Harris, Sarah, Eva Nibb, Rachel Harland and Rebecca Collins.
Thank you, Douglas. That's great.